Okay, let's get started. I'm Sally Caputo, Director of Operations and Programming for the Association of Management Consulting Firms, and I'd like to welcome you to our webinar today, What It Takes to Succeed in Consulting. This program is brought to you by the Association of Management Consulting Firms, or AMCF, and is part of our university program called Consulting Career Connection. Just please note that we will be taking questions today, and we urge you to ask your questions throughout the webinar. Just use the chat function on your screen there and pose the questions to the chairman. We'll be taking the questions after our dialogue in the order in which they were received. So at this point, I'd like to turn it over to John Firth, who is the president and CEO of AMCF. John?
Thank you, Sally, and welcome all those who are attending and on the telephone and watching the screen. For those of you who do not know AMCF, i.e. the Association of Management Consulting Firms, we are the global trade association representing the breadth and the diversity of the management consulting industry. We do represent the industry as a collective, with a collective voice, and we promote knowledge exchange, professional standards, a code of ethics, and so forth for the community of management consulting firms around the world. Thus, our mission is to promote an environment which fosters the success of management consulting firms and the value they deliver to clients. This, of course, means that we talk to a number of constituents, and if Christina would go to the next one, yeah, the AMCF has launched a university program this year. In the midst of the revival of the economy, we as a profession and industry are obviously looking for the best talent we can get. We are all about our people. In fact, that is our most important and our largest asset. And therefore, we have launched what we call the Consulting Career Connection. It is an information hub, a forum to learn, interact, and collaborate. And this is specifically tailored to those of you on the phone. In fact, students at multiple universities around the United States are taking part in this program, everything from MBA to non-MBA programs, undergraduate, PhD, and so forth. We ask you join us for upcoming webinars, as well as the consultingcareerconnection.com, which is the community-based platform. And here's a picture of that, consultingcareerconnection.com. So let's get started. And we wanted to ask a few polling questions very quickly so that we know who's on the phone. As I said, we have a very full house here. But please, if you could just check on one of these three boxes, whether you are working or have worked or currently are working in management consulting, and we'll see the results in a moment. Okay, not unexpectedly, most of you on this phone are new to this industry. A few of you have been in consulting beforehand, and there are a few interns. So that's good. This is really meant for those of you who have very fundamental questions about consulting, how to succeed in consulting. So let's go to the next question. Where are you currently based? We'd just like to get some sense of the geography here. And again, not totally unexpected, the Northeast and the Midwest, specifically the area around Chicago and Detroit, are very large centers of consulting. Obviously, I see a number of you who must be in Seattle and so forth. But, you know, New York, D.C., Boston, Chicago are obviously some of the most important centers, not only for the industry, but also for the universities that feed us the talent that we need. And I see we have a few people outside of the U.S. Great, let's look at the next one. What level education program are you currently enrolled in? Again, we do, this program is meant for everybody, regardless of which program they have either absolved, finished, or are currently in. Okay, and I'm glad to see that we seem to have a really healthy mix of both undergraduate and graduate master's programs. So let's move to the last one. What is or was your major of concentration? Given that we probably have a few graduates, just what was your last degree or the major you're in right now? Interestingly enough, compared to the webinar we held a few weeks ago, we seem to have more engineering and especially more liberal arts in this, which is always very satisfying to see. This is obviously a career not just for MBAs. It is a career that we recruit from across the spectrum. So I'm glad to see that we have additional concentrations represented on this call. Great. Well, then let's get started. We have 4 points we want to cover in this agenda, and it's really, again, for getting started, those of you who are looking to get started in this career. So, you know, there are many firms out there. There are really tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, and so there's a question of choosing the right firm so that you know that there's a fit. And then we want to talk a little bit about when you get started, what can you expect? What will you see? What will you experience? And then everybody wants to do well, especially when they're starting in a career. So we want to talk a little bit about that. And then take you really up to the first promotion, which can happen anywhere after the first, second, third, fourth years. And that's when the skill sets needed, the kinds of work you do will start changing. So we want to take you through the first, sort of from now until the first year or two of your career in the profession. So with that, I'd like to introduce our two speakers. Michael LaPorta, former senior partner of Deloitte Consulting, and Bill Mattisoni, former head of marketing at McKinsey and BCG. I'd like them to have them introduce themselves, and then we'll go right into the program. So, Mike and Bill, over to you.
Hi, my name is Mike LaPorta. I joined the firm of Touche Ross and Company in 1972. I actually was I had the pleasure of working on the merger with Deloitte in 1989 and had a 33-year career spanning a number of roles, including many years spent in our management consulting group and culminating in leading our global insurance consulting practice at the time I retired from the firm. Bill?
That's it? That's all you're going to tell?
Well...
This is Bill Mattisoni. I want to point out that Mike's picture and my picture were taken a lot earlier than now. We're still just as handsome. I had when I got out of business school in 1975, I had no idea that I would spend the next 35 years of my life in and around management consulting. I thought business school was dull, and I thought the topic of management was really dull. But for a set of circumstances, I found myself taking a job in management consulting in Washington in 75, and my first job in management consulting lasted 3 months. I quit. The work was awful. The partners didn't really care about the quality of what I was doing, and there was no real intent on having any impact on the world. I guess the lesson from that is you can join some bad consulting firms, but you can also recover from them. I quit and joined another firm that was focusing on social marketing, and it turned out to be a great firm. And I really enjoyed the idea of social marketing. And then joined one of our clients. And, Mike, I don't know what the percentages are, but I don't know. How many people start in consulting and end up joining their client? Probably 30, 40, maybe 50%.
I would think.
Yeah. And... And I joined, my client was United Way of America, and I ran marketing for them for a couple of years. And then, strange set of circumstances, McKinsey asked me to join them. and help them build their reputation and protect their brand, which was a worldwide job. And I did that for 20 years and became a partner in 2 years and did everything from the external communication to our knowledge management systems to our competitive analysis. It was a terrific career there. And then I left to help sell another firm, a McKinsey offshoot, a $200 million firm, that we sold to an e-commerce firm. It was a bad idea, but we managed to sell the firm. And then I joined BCG and was head of marketing, innovation, and communications for BCG for 6 years. Now I run my own little consulting firm, and I really enjoy it because I can pick my clients and projects, and it's a lot of fun. And I guess maybe that's the icing on the cake of a 35-year career in management consulting. That's it.
All right, let me add a little bit more information on my side, because now that Bill's explained something, it's made me think of something. First of all, I went to an undergraduate school that had a what we called a co-op program. So I spent the equivalent of a year over three years of my undergraduate working for a Fortune company in their accounting department and management training program. And while I was there, I was assigned to be the client part of a team with a management consulting firm to do what was really a major headcount. And back then it was called headcount reduction. This is in like 1966, but you call it reengineering or something else now. It was an awful experience because the consultants they put on the project knew absolutely nothing, and the folks that I was working with at the it was a national supermarket chain were really making all the decisions, doing all the work, and I discovered that the reason the consulting firm, and it was a good brand name firm, was hired was so that management wouldn't have to take the heat for firing all these people. And I decided, boy, I don't want to be a consultant. So I did get an MBA, and I went to work for Touche Ross as an accountant in the auditing profession, which I thought was an honorable profession. But I was recruited to transfer into consulting after a year, and I did it reluctantly. But it turned out to be the best decision I ever made, because the way we did consulting at Touche Ross and ultimately Deloitte and Touche, I think we added a lot of value to many clients over a year. The other thing I'll say is that in working for a firm like Deloitte, I started out as an auditor. I spent 1 year on the audit staff, moved to consulting, became a partner after 8 total years with the firm, 7 years in the consulting group, ran a geographic location for 4 years. My first 4 years as a partner, I ran the St. Louis consulting office. Then I became head of strategic planning for Touche Ross, did the merger with Deloitte, I was head of the St. Louis office for a while as well, audit tax and management consulting. I then became head of strategy for Deloitte and Touche, and then moved back into management consulting in 1991 and continued to work there, ending as the head of the global insurance consulting practice. So being part of a firm that was as dynamic and that experienced the growth that we did at Deloitte, I was able to wear a lot of hats and save myself getting bored with doing anything too long. Meanwhile, building some wonderful equity in our partner retirement plan with 33 years there. So all said, it was a great career.
Great. Thank you. I think when I listen to the two of you speak, I think one of the fundamental questions you've answered, which is the variety of paths into consulting, the variety of paths when you're in the career, and then the things that you can do when you left the career. But I think also seeing the diversity of those listening to us, there is no one single path into consulting. And once you're there, there's all sorts of different things you can do, a real breadth of diversity. But let's move on to our first agenda point. Christina, if you'll switch. which is really the fundamental question of how do you find the right firm. And the two of you did bring this up. You know, Bill, you talked about being at the wrong firm and then being at the right firm, and that really makes a lot of difference. And I've been through a couple of firms, one or two where I was absolutely fully in line with what they wanted to do and what I wanted to do, one or two that was not at all the right fit. And the good news is, you know, you get out of the wrong firm quickly and you stay with the good firms for as long as you want. So let's go to a polling question. We want to see what some of our listeners think. So let's, before we get started, everybody please select the top three attributes that you think of when you evaluate your interest in a specific consulting company. What do you look for when you want to choose a consulting company? I see there's still quite a lot of people answering. But I think we're getting a bit of a consensus here that company reputation, prestige, and corporate culture are probably the two most important things. Connected to that, obviously, is the types of engagements and clients. Interesting enough, and this is for those of us who have been in the industry, the compensation is not one of the top three generally. We as consultants certainly look for a lot of other satisfaction other than, you know, big pay packages. Again, the type of work and the people you work with tend to be very up at the top as it is represented here. I think the other interesting thing is the opportunity to travel is indeed fairly low. We are aware of the fact that sometimes the travel needs of projects and of clients are much higher than those young consultants who want to do that kind of travel, and as an industry, we do think about that. We do work with our young hires to really find the optimal mix for them that works for us as a firm and for the clients, but also helps young consultants fit that into their lifestyle wishes. Let's go to the next one, Christina. Now, size is very important because there are huge differences, and we'll talk about this in a second. So if you could just let us know sort of what size consulting firm do you think you'd be most happy at? And again, we're seeing a bit of a trend formulate here. Interestingly enough, I also chose medium. I'm a kind of a medium-sized consulting guy, and that seems to be where the trend is going. I would say if it's like myself, small may be a little bit too intense, but large may be too much like a factory, so that sort of medium-sized company, of which there are many, many of that size, seem to be able to find a good balance. So I would say I'm also part of that trend. Let's go to the next one. Okay, this last question, what line of consulting business are you most interested in? This, again, helps us focus the discussion a little bit. And of course, if those of you were wondering what the categories are, strategy are the McKinsey, BCGs, business advisory would be a Deloitte, KPMG, PwC, HR is Towers Watson or Mercer, Aon Hewitt, IT would obviously be Capgemini, IBM, Accenture, Business Forensics, Navigant or FTI, and then all those small niche firms. And again, not unexpectedly, since many undergraduates and graduate students really look towards the big names of the industry, again, BCG McKinsey in the strategy field, this should not surprise us, follow them closely by business advisory and then smaller firms. So let's talk about this a little bit, guys. Bill, why don't we start with you? Since you were really in strategy, what made you gravitate towards that? Why do you think at the end of the day that was really the right kind of firm for you or quite line of business for you to be in? What was about your work there that said that was for you? And by the way, please speak loudly, Bill and Mike. We got a few comments. People are having trouble hearing you, so let's just make sure we speak loud and clearly for everybody.
Okay, I'm not on a speaker, so I should be coming through. I don't think strategy attracted me to McKinsey. Its reputation attracted me. You know, it was known as the best firm and a top strategy firm, yes, but strategy didn't mean anything to me. I think there are advantages to joining a big firm like McKinsey or Deloitte because you get really good basic training and you have opportunities to do work in different areas, and that's key in consulting. You want to keep educating yourself. It's one of the reasons you become a consultant. I'll talk more about that later. So the big firms can give you that early training that's key, and then you can join a medium or smaller firm. It's a little more dangerous to do it the other way around, I think. Mike, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I'm recalling back. I wouldn't classify Deloitte as a business advisory firm at all, because we do a huge amount of strategy, and probably IT is the biggest revenue producer in the firm. So, and that's what happens when you've got a firm that's in the billions of dollars of revenues. There's virtually everything is being done there. So, and there's a role for everybody. I think to me, joining a large firm with all the support that is available, if the culture fits you, that's where I would tend to advise people to go. The one thing I've always told people I was recruiting, I spent a lot of my time recruiting over my career, is that especially if you're a highly sought after candidate, you're going to probably have your pick of several firms, and it's really up to you to get to know the firm, because a lot of firms are going to make you offers, and you're in a better position to figure out if you fit with the firm than the firm is ever going to be able to figure out if you fit with them. So I think it's important that you do research, meet as many people as you can during the process. Find out if it's going to feel right for you to join that firm.
Mike, just following up on that, you mentioned sort of the big firm, Deloitte, obviously lots of opportunities. You can almost sort of forge your path and pick and choose, certainly when you're young, from projects and say, hey, I want to try a little bit of strategy and then maybe do something technology-oriented. Bill, you worked at a small firm. So what are some of the advantages of small firms versus a big firm?
Well, the smaller firms, can have real focus. I mean, I love that firm I worked for down in Washington after my first terrible experience in consulting. I liked the concept of social marketing. I thought it was good for the world. Social marketing was about behavior as the medium of exchange versus money. And it's a concept that's grown in power over the years. So it's a smaller environment. You have a real focus. You really can get deep and learn something that will keep with you for the rest of your lives. And if you're lucky, a small firm will have 5 to 10 partners. You'll get to know 3 or 4 of them, work with them, and it'll be a terrific education as you watch these partners and how they perform and understand why they succeed. That's the advantage of a small firm. That said, a big firm, you will turn into a small firm because nobody can experience a big firm in its entirety. So you'll form your own little McKinsey or your own little BCG, your own little Deloitte, and you can do the same thing. The advantage of a small firm is it's much more of a family.
Now, not everybody, let's come back to the strategy question, because we do know that they're very difficult firms to get into. And I do know those firms look very carefully at the candidates. How does one look at these strategy firms and say, and how do you tell them apart? Bill or Mike, jump in here. Maybe Bill, you can cover the strategy firms. And Mike, I know you don't like the word business advisory, but again, if you put Deloitte, KPMG, PwC, and others into that mix, for an outsider, especially someone who hasn't been in the industry, it's hard to tell them apart. Maybe Mike, you can talk a little bit about what sort of things you should be asking. What are some of the differences you see that would maybe, you know, sway a candidate to focus on one firm more than the other?
Well, one of the things I can speak mostly about is Deloitte, and what I thought distinguished us from a lot of firms, not all firms, and that was how quickly our entry-level people got in front of a client and actually had opportunities to work directly with clients. And some firms, including some we acquired, most junior people really stayed in the office doing a lot of analysis, but never really got to see the client until they were further along in their careers. Whereas at Deloitte, our philosophy is to work in the client's office, not in ours. And I would typically take the boardroom and put a team in there or a training room. At one client we had three-fourths of a floor because we were doing a lot of work there. And, our folks are right there with the client. Now, if that's something that is attractive to you, that is something you should look for when you're going through the process. If it's not attractive to you, you might be wanting to think about another career because whereas at Deloitte, you'll get that experience right away. At some other firms, you'll get it later, but you'll get it. I mean, and that's where eventually all the action really happens is in the client's office. So the question is, how quickly do you want to move into that location? And that would be a big driver. And the other one is, how much responsibility are you given for an assignment, and when will you be actually able to get out of a pure analyst role and into a role where you're formulating recommendations and at least running them up the flagpole to a manager or a partner on a project?
Philip, what would you say about the strategy firms?
The remarkable thing to me about the strategy firms, and I really only know McKinsey and BCG, but I know a little bit about Bain from my days competing with them, is they're all very different, even though they're all in the top management strategy, big picture part of the matrix in consulting firms. I would say McKinsey is very much of a, in terms of its culture, I would call it a contribution culture. It is expansive in the way it credits people for the things they contribute to the firm. And it doesn't have to simply be revenue. In fact, in the late 80s, McKinsey changed the way it evaluated partners so that revenues did not even get into the brief on what they contributed to the firm. They valued relationships much more highly than revenue. That's quite different than what you had at the Boston consulting firm, where revenues mattered a lot. And I don't mean that derogatively. It was just much more of a credit culture where what you achieve is, in terms of revenues to the client, is what matters in terms of your standing and in terms of your compensation at the end of the year. Also, McKinsey was very much about relationships with senior managers. Dinners with your clients are part of the drill when you finally become part of the firm. But even as an associate, you're expected to be out there building relationships, not simply sitting at your desk doing analysis. Again, BCG was the opposite. You need to look at these things. You need to find out, you know, where are you going to be comfortable? Do you want to be more social? Do you want to be friends with your clients? Or do you want to just be a superb problem solver who's making the world run better, which is how BCG often sees themselves? Or for Bain, do you really want to take the client apart and put it back together again so that it creates more economic value, which was the driving philosophy behind Bain, which I think was powerful. They're all very different firms.
Great, thank you. And I can say from my own experience, other strategy firms like Oliver Wyman, Roland Berger, Booz & Co., also have very specific things that they focus on in terms of expertise, but also have their own unique corporate cultures. One last thing I would throw in before we go to our next topic is, of course, many firms are now public or part of public companies such as Oliver Wyman, part of Marsh McLennan. But for the most part, two of you grew up in the partnership model. Maybe you can quickly just give us a sense of what it means to be part of a partnership as opposed to a public company. Michael?
Having not been part of a public company, I can't really speak to that. The partnership mode is, I don't know. It's really changed over the years. When I became a partner in 1980, I knew every other partner in the management consulting group. I just knew them and trusted them, and we had social activities, national meetings where we played cards until dawn. I mean, it was a great camaraderie experience. When I retired, I had, I don't know, 1,000 partners. It was impossible to know them all, and it became, and I was actually on the compensation committee my last few years, and, we were actually compensating partners that in a room where only a few of us actually knew the partner. We're basically doing that on a, based on a lot of data and feedback. And I mean, we had, a pretty good process, but it was quite different when it gets to be such a large group. So, I mean, that may be something to be said for being a partner in a smaller firm. Certainly being a staff person in a larger firm, I think that it has all the advantages. I think if I were in a firm with 200 or 300 partners, I think that might be the ideal situation. But I would not make a decision now about what firm to join based on that particular part of the model. I really think because I think there's a tendency to kind of overplan your career. I got from the sense of Bill's story and knowing him, he didn't plan his career that much, and I certainly didn't either. I was I never expected to retire from Deloitte. I always thought something else would capture my imagination, and I'd go do something else. But they kept putting a different challenge in front of me that I wanted to tackle. So I was able to stay there a long time. But I think, and I also watched colleagues who did try to overplan things. Most of them weren't that successful. So I think if people just, if they have the appropriate talent set and the right kind of attitude and some smarts about them, they'll be just fine through a career that may start in consulting and end in consulting, or go in and out of consulting, or start consulting and end up in a corporate position.
Great. Yeah, I would just say that I've always said I have the magpie approach to consulting, or magpie approach to my career, which is if it looks like fun and it's cool, I want to do it. And so, I sort of go from job to job, from project to project, based on just whether I think this fulfills an inner desire or a skill set that I want to get, or just simply an industry I want to look at more. It's great for people who have ADD, I always say. Sally, did you have – sorry?
I would just add, from a viewpoint of somebody thinking about getting into consulting, and this is a truly biased comment, is join a privately – held firm, a partnership. Do not join a publicly held firm. The behavior that being publicly owned forces is, to my mind, not good for your development as a young person. And I'm sure the publicly owned firms would argue with me on this. But in a partnership, and Mike would agree with this too, is start behaving like a partner from the day you join the firm. Don't behave like somebody who's working for McKinsey, Deloitte, any of the other big firms. Think like a partner. Treat each other with respect. You're not competing anymore. You're there to do a great job for your clients by helping the client directly and helping others on your team where you can. I remember actually, you know, I was fortunate. I got to McKinsey, and within 2 years, I was elected a partner. And then I had a big meeting with a managing partner who I was, you know, I knew pretty well, and guy running all our practices, and somebody from Germany who was key to things. And I started running the meeting as if I was reporting to them and giving them, you know, here's what we got done, here's what we accomplished. And Fred Gluck, the managing partner to be, grabbed my arm and whispered in my ear, "You're a partner, for Christ's sake. Behave like a partner." And what he meant by that is, you know, you're past those tests. You're competent. That's why we brought you in here. So don't be arrogant, but you know, think for yourself, take risks, don't worry about your scores anymore. That's part of a career that you're going through now. Don't do it when you become a consultant.
Yeah, I will echo one of the things Bill said really resonates with me. You're not going to be in competition with anybody when you join a firm like McKinsey or Deloitte or BCG. There's so much demand for people with the right talent and skills that if you can deliver them and if you possess them, you will advance, and you don't have to beat another person out, because the whole firm prospers much, much more if all the boats rise. And so competition is really a killer. And at Deloitte, if we saw someone acting that way and looking out for themselves rather than for the client and for their colleagues, they, you know, counseling would occur. And
yeah, right.
Very good. Very good point. Just a quick note, we are getting questions in. We will handle those towards the end, time allow. Some of them are a little bit personal, and I would suggest that you go to the microsite that I mentioned. We'll show you the website name in a sec at the end. Please use those forms for the more personal type of questions. Obviously, we have many people on the phone. But let's go to the next agenda point. What can you expect during your first month or year? And we want to start with the polling question. Again, select the top three attributes that you think are important for a successful career in consulting. Okay, we're starting to get some of the results in. I'm very heartened to see that those on the phone recognize that this is a very people-oriented business, and that is by far and away the one that we're seeing as the top attribute, followed by creativity and entrepreneurial spirit. So I suspect when we start talking about this that Bill and Mike, you probably wouldn't disagree too much with that.
Those were the three I picked, John.
Right. There you go. And Bill,
actually,
I assume?
No, they actually were the three I picked. Because I think that's three very good answers to that question. I saw that question when it was on the slide and started thinking about it early. I've got to say, you got to keep in mind, first impressions are important. I mean, they're very important. And when your first day on the job, you know, people are going to size you up early, and they're going to make some conclusions based on how you perform early on in your career. And if you have a hiccup or two early on, you need to recognize it, and you need to figure out and get some help on how to fix it. Because I was very fortunate. I had an experience where I actually discovered a client fraud my first day on the job and ran it up the flagpole, and all of a sudden people were, you know, talking about, wow, this guy, you know, has got his head up and he's aware and that sort of thing, which is one of the things that we look for. You know, equally, you know, if you have a disaster early on, you know, you probably should get some help and figure out how to fix it. But, how, you know, what your personal appearance is like, how you communicate, looking people straight in the eye, when you talk to them, all the things that make people, you know, want to be with you. Those are very important things to figure out and get accomplished early. And I know that's a little bit artificial, but you know, it's really important. The other thing is, you know, whatever task you're given, accept it with a smile and do your best, and turn in a work product that is, you know, is exemplary. And actually, if you just keep doing that, more than likely you'll be a partner.
Yeah,
at some point.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Although, curiously enough, John, being deep somewhere, and I'm looking at that box called specific marketable knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
It helps to be deep somewhere. In fact, because you know there's demand for that knowledge. Don't kid yourself about it. Fred Gluck at McKinsey used to say, "You can't be a great generalist unless you're really a deep specialist someplace."
We call that have something to say.
Yeah, exactly. And Fred's standard for that is if you can't go toe to toe for 3, 4, 5 hours with somebody in that area, in your client, you know, you're not deep enough.
And like not knowing which three department cabinets you'd abolish.
Yeah, that might not be deep enough. But the point is, you know, there's at McKinsey we call it a T-shaped consultant. Some WAG call it a pie-shaped consultant. I think at one strategy session we called ourselves spiky integrators. But the point is, you got to become both broad and deep. You get broad by being adventurous. Don't worry about your assignments. You know, just keep learning all sorts of new things. But pick an area where, you know, it's valuable to clients, it's valuable to the firm, and it's interesting to you. It could be intellectual property, you know, whatever the topic. It could be an industry or an offshoot of an industry. That will help you. Sooner rather than later, you're going to have that T-shaped profile.
Yeah, I would say that the way I was brought up, it was more around functional skill than it was about industry, though, because
yeah.
Don Curtis was one of my mentors, and you know, he would say, you know, J.P. Morgan doesn't need another banker. They got thousands of them, okay?
Right,
so,
right.
But they do need somebody that knows how to figure out this or figure out that, which is the problem they're dealing with. So industry knowledge, the way we worked at Deloitte, and I know that some of the firms really don't care at all about industry knowledge, but the way we worked at Deloitte, it was kind of the price of admission. We didn't want to put people on a client, unless they were, you know, in their first or second year, that really didn't understand banking or didn't understand insurance,
right,
at a pretty good level. But you know, the client is much smarter about, you know, the insurance policies they offer or the way they market their products or how their sales, you know, forces organize. And that, well, I'm getting out of there. They know more about the insurance product than, you know, than any of our guys will ever know, because it's their products. But how to structure a technology system to support that new product, or how to organize the sales force to be more effective, that's where we can really add a lot of value. And it's not about knowing more about insurance regulations or actuarial theory or that sort of thing.
Yeah, I used to make the point that for young people in a firm like ours, 3 or 4 studies is probably enough. 2 is probably not enough. But if you do 4 studies in banking, given the kind of furnace that an assignment is, where you're learning everything rapidly, you're way up the curve. You're better than a professor at a business school at that point. And you don't need to do any more. So what you have to do, but the trouble then was people will want you to keep doing work in that particular area. And you've got to be the one that says, no, I'm gone deep enough now. I need to keep learning about other things. And the importance of managing your own education, even though you're letting things happen pretty much to you in these consulting firms in the early years, is really important. If you get to be, you know, if you get to your 9th study on some topic, it's time to move on.
Yeah, but you know, here, this is kind of a good little discussion, Bill, because again, it highlights the differences between a successful career at McKinsey and one at, say, Deloitte. Because
yeah.
Eventually at Deloitte, you're going to end. I ended up doing nothing but insurance.
Yeah.
Okay, and someone else is going to do nothing but health care. And that's how we're organized, and that's how we deliver. And I'll tell you, I used to love to go to the trade shows and meet all the other folks I've known for years in the insurance industry. And we tell stories, and we have fun, and we go drinking and all those things. And there's plenty of clients in that one industry to keep, yourself and many, many teams busy. So that's probably a big difference between a firm like Deloitte and a firm like McKinsey. I mean, you will end up specializing in an industry.
Yeah. Well, you know, the industries are important at McKinsey too, but I would bet that both at Deloitte and at McKinsey, even when you're in that industry, you still have your own personal learning agenda, and you're not just doing the same work over and over.
That's true. Yeah.
Question though to you too. If you think back of your first start in consulting, what was it like when you first walked into your first consulting company and really your first consulting assignment?
Well, I'll tell you my first one because I love it. I mean, we got to remember now, this is back in 1973, okay, so things were a lot different then. And it was a two-person project, and the project manager on the project ended up being the CEO of Touche Ross at one point, okay? And he sold a project to an insurance, and this is weird because my first and last assignment was with insurance, and I did everything in between, from dairies to retail companies to supermarkets to construction companies, and I can keep going on. But my first assignment was with a large insurance agency that also had what they call a premium finance company associated, so that you could, rather than pay monthly to the insurance company, the agent would lend you the money to pay your premium in advance and so on and so forth. And it was a reorganization job. It was internal systems and all those things. And I began working with the CEO, like, on day one. And, we would go out and get – he would, buy me a shoe shine. We and our wives were having dinner at his ranch. We'd meet in the steam bath at the Jewish Community Center for meetings. I mean, it was quite an experience. Working with this kind of eccentric entrepreneur, and I was quite young, it was a great learning experience about the kinds of situations you might have to adapt to.
Bill, from your side?
There was no hanky panky in the steam room, but taking a steam with the CEO was not something I was expecting. In my first year as a consultant.
Well, I would think back to not McKinsey, but that firm where I was in the social marketing arena. My first client was the National High Blood Pressure Education Program, run out of the National Institutes of Health. And our objective was to increase people's adherence to therapeutic regimens. You know, when you get high blood pressure, it's not curable. You have to keep taking the pill. You have to watch. You have to keep taking drugs to reduce your blood pressure. You have to watch what you eat, all that sort of stuff. It's not a message people want to hear. Well, working with a government client, again, some people might be excited about that, did not excite me. 25 people around a table, 20 of whom did not need to be there, and 20 of whom really didn't care about accomplishing the objective. Five did. And I sort of picked those guys out, and women, and made them my client rather than the National Institutes of Health. And then I decided I really wanted to know much more about the literature and theory behind therapeutic regimens. What gets people to comply? And, you know, a lot of it had to do with repeat purchasing and figuring out how to get pharmacists involved and thinking through the distribution channel. So even though the client wasn't much fun, and I certainly wasn't having the fun Mike was having with his client, I really was intellectually engaged with this challenge and then trying to translate it into what does this mean for the experience when somebody with high blood pressure goes to a drugstore? What does it mean for his or her experience with his family, you know, that kind of stuff? it was terrific learning. I don't know what the lesson is. The lesson is, if you got a lousy client, find a good client within that lousy client. And the other one is keep learning. Because the stuff I did learn on therapeutic regimens stuck with me for a long time, and I still am interested in the topic.
Excellent. Well, that actually is a very good segue into the third question, which is how to excel and achieve recognition. We've touched on many, many points. I always said the most important thing for a young consultant is to have curiosity, because that's what drives you forward. And I think you guys sort of reiterated that in several forms. But very quickly, and I know we've touched on this, Mike, give us three or four things that you think are really what a young consultant needs to show to excel and achieve recognition.
Well, first and foremost, I think you have to accept every assignment with a very positive attitude and produce a result that at a minimum meets expectations and ideally exceeds expectations. So you need to figure out, as you're doing that assignment, what it is where you can add value beyond what was expected by the project manager, but doing that without exceeding budget, because we always had budgets and you were allotted so much time to get a job done. So we used to kid about entry-level folks. We called them associate partners because they would come in as an associate. That was our first level title. And they wanted to be partners on day one. And, they would not necessarily focus on what they were asked to do, but do another task. And I wouldn't advise that. A manager's got a plan, an engagement plan, an expectation of certain deliverables he or she wants from you. Those have to be delivered, in excellent condition. And then if you can add some things to it that make the project more successful, that's kind of how you do it.
Great. Bill?
I don't like the words how to excel and achieve recognition, because it's back to competition again. Obviously, you do want to do these things, but I think Mike captured it. You make sure you do what you're asked to do, and you do it superbly. And then if you can also stretch people's imagination and stretch your own imagination, you do that as well. There was something earlier about behave like an entrepreneur. That's part of this, how you stand out, but stand out in the right way. You're not trying to beat anybody out. You're just trying to do a great job for the client. And, any good firm, the client will always come first. And then the firm comes second, and you come third. Keep those priorities in mind.
And I would just reiterate, clients notice very quickly if there's some dysfunctionality going on, if they see there's undue competition between the consultants or lack of cooperation. They pick up on that immediately, and it's not a good thing. And I think that's one of the great things of this industry is the esprit de corps and the way people really form teams, work together, and cooperate. But very quickly, we only have a few more minutes left, and I would like to see if we can entertain a couple of questions. What changes in your first promotion? Again, very quickly, Bill and Mike. Maybe
what
Mike,
changes?
You want to start? Yeah, what changes when you're suddenly getting promoted? What is it, the same old? Do you suddenly take on more responsibility? Does your work change the way you do your work?
Very little changed after my first promotion. And part of that might be because the culture at Deloitte was, when you're behaving like a senior consultant, you became a senior. When you behaved like a manager, you were made
right,
a manager.
Right.
So,
David McKinsey. Yeah.
It was typically a couple of years for the first promotion, and your second year, if you're not mentoring the first year people and helping them be successful, you're probably going to have to leave the firm. So, and that's what is part of the job description of what we call now a manager. So a manager is responsible for people development, but a second-year consultant is also responsible for that of the folks that are just joining. So, and by the way, I guess that's something we didn't talk about in the last question. If you should be you should be mentoring people as soon as you've figured out the job. Help some others. And I would keep that up until the day you leave the firm.
Very good advice. Bill, what about from your side?
I totally agree with Mike. Obviously, you got to become a better project manager as you graduate to higher positions in the hierarchy. But this mentoring point is a very good one. You start helping others. One of the things that people are in short supply, maybe not just MBAs but others, is empathy. Put yourself in somebody else's shoes and try to do it all the time. Empathy is one of the most valuable skills you can develop, and it doesn't matter if you haven't been a particularly empathic person in your tens and teens and 20s. You can develop those skills by constantly asking, where's that person coming from? And that's probably what distinguishes between the capable consultants and the truly good ones.
You know, it reminds me back to that question about my first job, first project. The manager, you know, he sold the job to the client. He handed me the engagement letter and said, now do a work plan on getting this work done. I mean, I said, what? He said, do a work plan. How are you going to get this job done? And, I put a plan in front of him, and he helped tune it up, and that's what we did. And, I began doing that as I, moved up in responsibility. It was very important for us to convey to our consultants exactly how a consulting project happened and how you kept it, profitable for us and valuable for the client, so on and so forth. And again, that was also part of the mentoring process.
Excellent. Great. Thank you, guys. Sally, is there a question from the audience? We have about 3 or 4 more minutes left.
Sure, John. We've got lots of questions here. We're not going to be able to get to all of them, so I would urge everyone to please visit our consultingcareerconnection.com site, and we're going to post some of these questions and answers on the site. But let's take this first one. It's a meaty one. What do I do if a client won't listen to me?
Fire
them. I have no idea. There's so many implications of that. You'd need a little bit more texture to that one. Bill's right. And if you've done all your homework and you know where the answer is, and the client won't listen to you, send them the bill and go to another client.
Yeah, and I would come back to empathy too. What can you do if you presented all the analysis and all the reasoning, all the logic, and the client still doesn't want to do it? Well, there's something holding that client back, right? Figure it out.
And one thing that I was brought up to understand, we do all this data analysis, and we put presentations together that have all kinds of data associated with them, and it's a very logical presentation. But the client's decisions end up being emotional, no matter what.
Yeah.
And so you've got to tap into that if you want your ideas to be heard and implemented. And so the data and the presentations are a way to elicit the appropriate emotional response from the client.
And I would also add in that often there are contextual things going on in a client's firm, company, that you're only vaguely aware of. And a consultant can't know everything. And sometimes decisions based on what you've recommended get modified or taken in other directions simply because they got what they needed from the consultant, but they had to move in a different direction or the decision was influenced by factors that either you weren't aware of or were not asked to consider. So it's not a sign of defeat if a client doesn't take your recommendations or they come out differently than maybe perhaps the way you formulated them.
Okay, well, I could debate that for a while, but we don't have enough time because I really think if you're working at the right level, if you're going to really be valuable, you need to know where all the bodies are buried. And if the client's not, as we say, open in the kimono, you're not going to be successful.
Right. It depends on the kind of project, too. It depends on the project, too. Strategy project, I would agree. I did a lot of post-merge integration, and I have to say, in the craziness to get the post, you know, get the merger going and get it integrated, sometimes it was even hard to track where the recommendations landed and how they were used because things were going so quickly.
You know, we were brought into a client to solve a particular problem. We went there to kind of close the deal, and the senior executive that had engaged us, we hadn't started work. We'd just gone in to really scope out the project with the client. He gets a phone call, excuses himself, comes back, and he had gotten fired in the 10 minutes that we were there. He was flown all the way to Omaha to meet with this guy.
Oh, God.
and it violated an important – he made the company millions of dollars by hedging out something, and it turned out that there was a policy against speculative hedging, as you might expect. And he thought he was going to get rewarded.
Oh,
and he got fired instead.
Sally, maybe we have time for one last question.
Okay. How about, as a young consultant, do I have any latitude to determine what projects I end up working on?
I would say I hope you don't.
I'd say probably not.
Yeah, probably not. You know, when I was at McKinsey, I ran all of our internal communications, our internal magazines, and whenever we elected partners, we would talk to them about their careers, and we would ask them a question about, were there times when you got assignments that you really thought were the wrong assignment, that you weren't interested, was going to hurt your career? And almost 90% of the time they said, yep, I got those assignments, and it turned out it was a great assignment. It looked like a lousy assignment, but it turned out to be a great one. Don't try to manage. If you get into a firm, do not try to manage your assignments, and don't worry about them. Just as Mike said, deliver, over-deliver on them, and then try to be entrepreneurial about it.
Great. Mike, anything from your side?
Well, the only thing I would say is the only what I would call lousy assignments, because, I mean, if you're going to be successful, you're going to find something fun and valuable in any assignment. There are some cases where a new client is abusive, and we just fire those clients. But apart from that, it could seem very mundane or very unimportant what you're doing. And as you involve yourself, if you can't figure out how to change that, you're not looking hard enough. No one's spending money at the rates we charge for something trivial. So I would say every assignment is a valuable assignment. And if you're not enjoying it, you're probably in the wrong career.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I always learned something listening to Mike and Bill, and I certainly hope everybody on the phone did as well. Sally, are we sending out a survey for those participants so we get an idea of what worked for them and what interested them?
Yes, we'll be sending an electronic evaluation form, and we do ask that if you could just take a minute to fill that out. We are very interested in hearing what we can do going forward to meet the needs of those on the phone, as you are, you know, our target audience for this university program. So that will be going out today.
Great. And again, many, many thanks, Bill and Mike. We look forward to continuing the series and hope to see many of these, if not see, maybe hear or have these participants involved in other aspects of this program.
Great. It's our pleasure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Please stand by.